Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Talk Gnosis. Jonathan Stewart here, and I've got my co-host. We now have rotating hosts and co-hosts, but tonight it's Bishop Lady Peterson. Say hi,
Hello.
Bishop.
Hello.
We've got a really awesome show for you. Tonight we are doing part two of Temple Theology. Now, if you're watching this on YouTube and or if you're listening to it as a podcast, if you check the notes, you will see that I've linked to our previous show on Temple Theology. You may want to check that out first so you have a bit of a background. And tonight we're specifically doing how Temple Theology connects to Gnosticism. And joining us to discuss this is Bishop Tim Mansfield.
And
hi,
hello.
Bishop Tim.
Hello,
hey,
Bishop.
How's it going,
Tim?
Folks? Nice to be here. Nice to be back.
Yeah, we're happy that you're back. And Bishop Tim is joining us live from Australia, from the future. Let's just start. Bishop Tim, we're going to pretend that everybody knows what Temple Theology is, that they have watched your previous show or read some of the articles.
I think we established last time that it takes about half an hour. It takes the first half of the show to establish what the...
Okay,
it takes about
okay.
the first half of the show to work out what the heck Temple Theology is
yes.
Obviously what I was saying.
Folks, this is also the first time that we've done the show live in a long time. We were doing a pre-recorded, so...
You can't trust Australian clergy is the short answer there. Do you want me to... There's probably a couple things I can say to help ground things for people, I guess.
Yes, please.
In terms of what we're talking about. So, broadly, we're talking about the work of Margaret Barker over the last 25 years, who's written a dozen or so books about temple theology. When she began that work, a lot of what she was saying was reasonably controversial, but it's more and more of it is becoming kind of mainstream stuff. The basic thing is to just unground your head from the idea that what happens in the temple in Jerusalem, the second temple in Jerusalem, and the way that's depicted in the Bible is the whole history of Hebrew religion over the past 3,000 years, because it's not. That is not the case. So the history of Hebrew temple worship is divided into kind of three periods. There's obviously the exilic period, the period after 70 AD when the second temple's destroyed. That's the period we're obviously most familiar with. Prior to that, there's the period of the second temple, which goes from the Babylonian invasion. So again, it'd be great if I had my dates clearer, like 680 BC. Up to 70 AD, and then there's the first temple period, which is prior to that. Barker's premise is that the practice of Hebrew religion in the first temple period is dramatically different, significantly different in really key, important ways to do with mysticism and theology from the practice of Hebrew religion in the second temple period. There's obviously different schools of thought in every religious tradition over time, but there's a key pivotal moment where just prior to the Babylonian invasion, during the period that's referred to in Jewish history as the captivity, when the Jews are taken from Israel to Babylon for something like 65 years, and fuzzy on dates as usual. But just prior to that period, there's a particular king called Josiah, and this is documented in 2 Kings around chapter 20, does what Barker refers to as a cultural revolution, and she uses that term advisedly, because he very dramatically and forcibly changes the practice of Hebrew religion to be something different.
Right.
What we understand from textual analysis and from archaeological evidence, primarily historical critical textual analysis, is that while, you know, if you grew up in a Bible-informed Christian tradition, or you've read the Bible kind of without understanding a lot of the historical critical scholarship around it, the Bible presents itself to you as, okay, so in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth, then a bunch of things happened, there was a bunch of kings, and then Jesus, right? Here is the history of the people, and then Jesus, and then, you know. So you're presented with the whole thing as it phrases itself as a historical narrative. If you haven't read any scholarship past 1800, and most people haven't. Most ministers don't teach that stuff. If you're in a particular progressive literal parish in a mainstream denomination, you may be aware of this stuff, but most people aren't. And a lot of people come into Gnosticism or esoteric practice with that not terribly well-informed perspective. So if you haven't done that stuff, then you may still be thinking that Moses was an actual historical person who did a particular thing, and, you know, there was Abraham before that, and this is how the nation was formed. What we've come to understand, I think, and when I say we, I mean biblical scholarship broadly. I'm not a biblical scholar, so I don't know why I get to say we in the sense of the we that doesn't include me. What we've come to understand, I think, is that the precise order, the particular form, and the exact structure of each of the books of the Bible, their arrangement into the order that they are, and the narrative that presents, is an artifact of a couple of centuries before Jesus. Mm-hmm. It's topped and tailed a bit after that, but the primary structure of that is a couple of centuries before Jesus. So quite late, and it's phrased itself as a national narrative because that was the needs at the time to create a national narrative for the Jewish people oriented around the royal seat in Jerusalem. But that's not how actually things actually happened. So the specific, I think the question of what does temple theology have to say to Gnosticism orients around two things: the specific theological and mystical differences between the first temple cult and then what becomes the predominant practice of Hebrew religion after that. Mm-hmm. That, and also the social effects of that cultural revolution moment that Uzziah propagates, followed immediately by the destruction of the temple, the Babylonian captivity, and all the drama and upset that happens when you take the priesthood and the aristocracy of an entire people away and hold them as hostages to ensure a vassal people's compliance with a foreign power. You know, it's a traumatic thing. That does things to a people, right? Yeah. So that's the framing, I guess.
Okay. And I wanted to say something which I also kind of phrase as a question, but it's also kind of a statement. I don't want people to misinterpret. And again, this is still going to be a bit of an intro because there's so much of this stuff. And if you pick up a book by Margaret Barker, most of them are very, very large, very, very thick. She's a brilliant thinker, but it's not easy stuff to digest. So we're going to do our best, folks. But we find this stuff fascinating. We think you will, too. That said, if you just skim some of this temple theology stuff, some of it can sound sort of derogatory to the Judaism that comes out of the destruction of the Second Temple or modern Judaism. And I don't want people to get the wrong idea that the Jews have their own religion wrong. The way I understand it, and if you agree with me, Bishop Tim, is you had this sort of original temple cult, you had this cultural revolution, then elements of this original temple cult, this mystical tradition, become spread out and found in lots of different places. So in rabbinic Judaism, in Kabbalah, in Islam, in Christianity, in Gnosticism. So everybody has a little shard of this truth. And actually, what Margaret Barker does, and correct me if I'm wrong, Bishop Tim, is one of the reasons that her books are so thick is she actually looks at all of these sources, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So would you say that statement is correct? And in some ways, I find it even a positive statement, because she's really saying that all these different religions are much more similar than you would think, and they're brothers and sisters.
That's exactly right. So I've tried to be more careful about using the term Hebrew religion.
Yeah.
But you might just as well say Abrahamic faith in a way, because the religion is it's the ethnic practice of the Hebrew people. But even by, you know, like 200 BC, the Hebrew people are in Egypt and they're in Babylon and they're not just, you know, in the lands of Israel and Judah, right? The Hebrew people are a people and they're all over the place. It's the ethnic, it's the set of ethnic, cultural and religious practices of the Hebrew peoples. And then over time, what happens with the emergence of Christianity and then later the emergence of Islam in Arabia is that the authentic religion and practice of the Hebrew peoples becomes, you know, versions of that and forms of that become the religion and practice of other peoples in other places as far away as the exact opposite side of the world. Yeah. But we're talking about the kind of the wellspring, and it's really important not to see in some of the ways you read Barker, because she's trying to get to like what the nub of it is, it's easy to infer that there's some kind of like pure, like intact source that then gets diluted by all the terrible stuff that happens later. And that's not really what she's saying. It's certainly not really what the evidence says. It's you know, it's a bricolage that she's putting together. But there's themes that are magnified in some traditions and suppressed in other traditions. And so we're all, we're brother and sister descendant faiths from the version of Hebrew religion that was practiced sort of, we're talking around sort of 500, 600 BC.
Right.
Yeah.
So I guess if we could dive in, can you talk a little bit about how this temple theology actually might explain Gnosticism's origins? And I'll stop right there. Like a lot of people, this has gotten better in modern times. But like when I went to school and took some religion classes, the idea that the ideas around Gnosticism were still that these are a bunch of Greek ideas that come in the second century. Sort of infiltrate the Judaism and Christianity at the time. So and a lot of scholars have moved away from that model, but probably a lot of people watching and listening who know something about Gnosticism's origins still have that idea. But could you talk a little bit about how temple theology does explain the origins of Gnosticism?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the basic stuff that you find in the texts that we refer to as Gnosticism and those the aspects of those texts, which I think as moderns or postmoderns, if you like, draw a lot of us to it, which is equally important. I mean, there's what's in the texts, and we like some of that stuff and we ignore some of that stuff, the same as everybody does with the Bible, right? There's some key things, right? So there's feminine divinity. There are divine figures who are female or feminine. Barbalo, Sophia, Epinoia, Pronoia, Protenoia, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Feminine divinity, I think, is what gets a lot of us into the space. The sense of there being the kind of the tragic role of the cosmos, that there's a malign creator god and with a ranks upon ranks of archons that serve him, and that there's something broken about that system, so there's something broken about the cosmological system that runs the world. And the idea that there's a higher God, that there's a more transcendent divinity that sits behind this kind of broken creator, so that there's an account for the brokenness of the world, and for a lot of us, you know, also an account of how that can speak to my own sense of my own brokenness. So it's a cosmological and a personal, spiritual, or psychological factor. And also, there's a greater embracing wholeness, which leaks through into phenomenal reality behind that brokenness. So the feminine divinity, the high God, the broken God, if you like, I think are the key things. And the sense of everything in the visible, material, phenomenal world being somehow connected in some way. Emanation is the term that we use in most often in esotericism and Gnosticism, but that the world that we've got is grounded in and emerges out of that fundamental high deity. I think that's probably the key things, I think, in what we call Gnosticism, and each of those things has their basis in temple theology. So specifically, the notion of emanation, the high God, and feminine divinity are fundamental aspects of first temple Hebrew religion. That's got robust archaeological and textual evidence, and we know that's true. And you see different aspects of that in Essen material, Dead Sea Scrolls, the Enoch work, a lot of that stuff bubbling around. And it emerges through related traditions like Platonism, Pythagoreanism, Philo in Alexandria. It's the same stuff. It's all temple talk from Barker's point of view. So let me just bracket out the malign creator for a second and come back to that.
Yeah.
But these fundamental things, which is the sort of warm and positive aspects of the first temple cult. The first temple cult was based in the royal cult of the temple in Jerusalem, but also crucially echoed in other temples all throughout the Hebrew world. So there are temples all throughout Israel and Judah. There are temples. We know there are two temples, Elephantine and Leontopolis in Egypt, that where a version of that temple faith was practiced by Hebrew settlers in those countries, probably other temples in Arabia and Babylon and whatever. But they're all echoing the primary royal cult in the temple in Jerusalem. And the essence of that royal cult is that the king, who is the high priest, is the anointed. He is anointed in order to become the king. He sits upon the throne, and in sitting upon the throne, sitting down, being anointed, and then standing up again, or as you'd say in Greek, anastasis, which we translate as resurrection in English, but it literally means to stand up again, which is a very sort of prosaic way of referring to resurrection, but it's also a very prosaic way of saying get up out of your chair. The king sits there, you know, the crown prince sits down and the throne is anointed and crowned and then stands up again as the king. In that process of anointing, he becomes the Lord. Mm-hmm. So as well as the high God and this feminine divinity, there's the national God of Israel, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, the Lord. So the king becomes the Lord. He's kind of, the Lord is sort of superimposed upon the king. He's anointed as Emmanuel, as God with us. And when he walks forth out of the Holy of Holies from the throne to speak to the people, he is God amongst the people, right? So this template of the Ancient of Days, the transcendent high God, and then this embodied God who's with the people as the king. And then slightly in the background, but kind of moving around in a kind of a mysterious and interesting way, is the lady, the feminine divinity. And there's a whole talk about that on the Joe and I channel where I bang on about it for some time. She's in the old temple cult in Barker's thinking, she's embodied as the queen mother. So she's the mother of the king. So there's the Trinity. The Father, the Son, and this mysterious feminine presence that blows around. No one knows where she comes from or whither she goes. Oh, look, the Queen Mother is there at my shop today. Like, what's going on? So there's this, it is very mystical, and it's also very pragmatic and concrete and in the actual lives of actual people. So that's what we're talking 500, 600 BCE. That's the first temple cult. That's what you see reflected through the figures of the Trinity in early Christianity, and also the image of the Lady appearing in early Marian devotion in early Christianity. But you see it, we're talking about 500 to 600 years of independent evolution, because what happens at that Josiah moment, just prior to captivity, to the Babylonian captivity, is that that early cult is suppressed in the Jerusalem temple. When you read 2 Kings 20, 21, 22, 23, Josiah then goes about closing all the other temples that he's got any access to, shuts down all the other places of worship, takes all the priests from all the subsidiary temples throughout the land and brings them all to the temple of Jerusalem, makes them kind of vassal priests of the Jerusalem priesthood. So he suppresses any alternative way of doing the old thing, suppresses the worship of the lady, who's referred to as Asherah, takes away all her places of worship, all the cult objects that are in the temple, all the cult objects that are anywhere else, and makes it all go away, right?
Yeah.
Then the priests are taken captive by the Babylonians. That cult, which has only been around for a couple of decades at this point, then disappears. And so that suppression suddenly lifted, and they're instead politically suppressed by the Babylonians for, you know, better part of a century, I guess. And then the returning captives from Babylon come back with this more refined version of the new version of Hebrew religion that they want to be propagating, and that's what becomes the sort of mainstream Second Temple cult. But meanwhile, all those other temples and places in Egypt and Arabia and Babylon, all the popular devotion of the people continues with what the early temple cult was. So what I think we see in Gnosticism, in the positive aspects of Gnosticism, which is those figures, the sense of there being a savior who is regarded as the son of the great high God, the Ancient of Days, the one, the monad, the first invisible father, accompanied by this salvific, powerful, transforming presence of the lady, figured as Barbalo, or Sophia in some versions, but Barbalo or Pronoia, the first thought. That stuff that we get from Gnosticism, you see echoes of in all these other temple texts, like Enoch and Dead Sea Scrolls. That's the version of that first temple cult that's gone through several centuries of evolution in a place like Alexandria, where everyone's, you know, the people practicing this sort of esoteric religion are literate, educated people that are acquainted with the literature of the time and the language that other cultures use to explain similar concepts. So the stuff that we refer to as Gnosticism, because by and large, it comes from Egypt. It's largely, you know, the hub of that, at least the early stuff, the Sethian material, is Alexandria. So that's the explanation, if you like, is it didn't come out of nowhere. It's not a kind of fabricated invention out of the minds of crazy esotericists in Alexandria. It's a development of a faithful cleaving to an earlier form of Hebrew religion that had been suppressed in the kind of the homeland in Jerusalem.
Right. It can flourish in Egypt because it's separate from some of these politics, right? And there are, as you said, two temples in Egypt. It also, it's not a direct faithful continuation. We're seeing some mutations, which is what religion does, right?
Some really significant, important mutations, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So we're talking about this royal cult. Okay, this is great. So this is cool. So, I mean, that just what I've said, that just explains Christianity. We're all good, right? That's fine. That's where Christianity comes from. Awesome. Gnosticism is more complicated.
Yeah.
Sort of explains where Christianity comes from. So the royal cult, the only person who gets anointed is the king.
Yeah.
Right? The only person who undergoes resurrection is the king in this sense of resurrection, right? Sits down human, stands up God, if you like. What we're told, well, we're actually told in patristic Christianity, you know, in Christianity for the first few centuries, and this remains the case in mystical Christianity to this day, everybody undergoes this resurrection in this life. Everybody, you know, sits down on the meditation stool, if you like, and then stands up God having undergone theosis. Every priest is anointed. Every Christian is anointed at the baptism. This anointing is everywhere suddenly. The Eucharist, which Barker claims is related to the original atonement ritual, was once upon a time the province of the high priest and the priest, and now everybody's doing it. So, like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
So that's one key massive shift, is that instead of this being the province of the royal family and held closely within the temple priesthood in the very restricted precincts of the inner part of the temple, gradually over several hundred years turns into the kind of thing that any participant in the religion is expected to undergo, to the point where Jesus sitting in a room, you know, in the week before his crucifixion, can quite legitimately say, well, this is my body, right? We're good? This is my blood, right? This is not goat, it's bread. And this is not goat's blood, this is wine. This is not even the material of the atonement ritual, but he could meaningfully say, By taking my body and taking my blood, you're participating in me, and you are in me as I am in my Father, as my Father is in me and I am in you. So he explicitly speaks to that process of union, and it becomes not just the province of the priesthood. We all become initiated into this priesthood of all believers. So it becomes this sort of jailbroken, open-sourced people's thing. And that's a progressive process, I think, over those centuries. Because, you know, access to the original temple is denied to the people that feel that this expression of Hebrew religion is a more legitimate expression. They're not allowed to go there. They're not allowed to practice it. All the key cult objects have been taken away by Uzziah and then sacked by the Babylonians and lost. So they can't do it the way they used to do it. It's had to adapt, and it's had to find different ways to be, and it's had to find out ways to express itself in a more underground way, which is another thing a lot of us get drawn to Gnosticism from.
Yeah.
So yeah, absolutely not the same. Different in some really key aspects.
Yeah. Although Barker does call it the secret tradition, right? Because it does continue on in different forms. That also makes me think of Gnosticism, which talks about, secret oral traditions being passed down. That's what a lot of the texts say or hint towards, and that's what the heresiologists say, that, you know, the Gnostics always got something from Jesus or from disciples of Jesus and from Jesus's teachers and such, right?
Yeah.
So just another point of comparison, and not a question, but an observation before I forget. But you talked about the king / priest standing up, right? And that becomes anesthesia's. How do you say it?
I say Anastasis, but I'm not Greek, so yep.
Yeah. Anastasis. The Cephians, were one of the largest Gnostic groups and have all the really trippy punk rock dualist texts that that people really gravitate towards. They didn't call themselves Cephians, they called themselves the Standing Ones. The ones who stand. In Secret John, Adam can't stand until he lays there, right? He becomes the Standing One once Sophia breathes soul into him. I find that all very interesting.
It's very evocative. Let's stick with Secret John and come back to the question of the broken God and the broken cosmos, because that's the other key. That's the key piece that's not so present in a lot of other material that is so vividly present in Gnosticism and really present in the Cephian material.
Yeah.
And it's not a characteristic of First Temple, of the First Temple cult, as Barker describes it. So, like, what up with that, right? That's the key thing we've got to tussle with, I think. So there's this, you're all Gnostics out there, right? We're all good. We can say Demiurge and Yaldabaoth and everyone knows what we're talking about. Awesome. Okay. So there's this creator God who's not awesome. He's a kind of he's got severe attachment disorders and just a terrible kind of some kind of personality situation going on that's really hard to diagnose, and it's a bad situation. This is described really fairly thoroughly in Secret Book of John, the Apocryphon of John, right? Mm-hmm. What's that about? Because that sounds like you're taught, you know, versus the First Temple picture where there's the high God and there's the Lord who is the king. Are we saying that he was bad in some way? Are we saying that the God of the Old Testament is bad in some way? Well, that's a complicated question to answer. That's if there's time. One of the things when people read that very dualistic Gnostic material, the reality of the rulers, the gospel of truth, Secret Book of John, etc., you see this big dichotomy between the world of the Pleroma and the world of the First Father, and then the lower world ruled by the Demiurge, by Yaldabaoth. And there are three predominant interpretations of what that's meant to mean. It's cosmological. It's saying something about the nature of reality in some metaphysical way. It's psychological. It's saying something about the interior structure of the human being in terms of the way our soul is fabricated, the way our mind works, the way we are in our interiority. Or it's political. It's a critique of the Roman Empire or the rulers or something. And there's been different interpretations over the last 100 years that fall into one of those three categories. So the question obviously is, like, which of those three things is the real interpretation of what that book was meant to mean? And the answer, I think, is yes.
Yes.
Yep.
So in the ancient world, if you're talking about psychology, you're always talking about cosmology, because as above, so below. So that's the fundamental surrounding principle of all ancient thought in the Near East, is that if you're talking about the metaphysical structure of the universe, that's always a way of also talking about the interior structure of the human being. So that's a given. That's a gimme, easily. But the cool thing is, what's the political angle? Like, why is the political angle? Now, for those of you singing along at home, you've already worked this out, because you've seen the revolver in the drawer three times now. So when I pull it out and shoot the assailant, you'll be expecting it. The key moment when Josiah does this cultural revolution, suppresses the veneration of the First Father, suppresses the devotion to the Lady, removes the host of heaven from the Holy of Holies, suppresses popular piety, and replaces it with something that's about nailed down rules and laws that people have to follow explicitly, that they're told off about constantly by a controlling priesthood who remove all power from all other temples, centralize it under royal control, and insist that everyone has to now obey this really fixed set of rules. That seems strangely familiar.
Mm-hmm.
So when you read Secret John and you chew on it a bit, it's got this great sort of that two-level structure. It's all about parity. It's all about, you know, the realm of the Yaldabaoth is this Keystone Cops universe where the authorities never get anything right. They're constantly trying to control everything and messing up. Things are falling to pieces. you know, and they're always doing things which are an imitation of the higher world of the Father, but none of it works and none of it's effective and none of it actually gets what they're trying to accomplish. And it's all kind of barren and silly and it doesn't work, right? So that's a critique of this emerging Second Temple cult.
Yeah.
This is people that are very familiar with the power and the breadth of the mysticism that emerges from the First Temple world, which is the realm of the First Father. And they're sharply critical of this version that comes back, this version of temple worship. And it's important, you know, the version of temple worship that we're talking about no longer exists. It ended with the destruction of Jerusalem. But nobody does it. It's not Judaism. That's not how Judaism works. Judaism's a completely different tradition that's not grounded in this worship of the Second Temple. They've done their own thing as well. They're not... they haven't perpetuated this thing either. This particular period of a few centuries from the end of the captivity to the destruction of Jerusalem. Maybe nobody liked it very much. Maybe it just wasn't terribly popular outside of Jerusalem. So I think what's depicted in that picture of the malign creator is the picture of the creator that's given back to Hebrew peoples in the Bible that they get given. This vengeful, you know, I am the only God. There is no other God but me. You must obey my law, otherwise you will be punished, right?
Yeah.
That's the covenant. You obey the rules. This is not the cult of the First Temple. The cult of the First Temple is one in which, by the continual self-giving of God and the royal priesthood, the invisible and material worlds are woven together in bonds of covenant. It's ritual action and prophetic mystical enlightenment and leaders speaking with a prophetic voice inspired by God and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Completely different.
Which we still find in the Hebrew Bible, just to always put in the asterisks there, right? So like something like the Book of Isaiah, right? This would represent more this First Temple tradition than some of these
still
more
all
negative
there.
Qualities of the...
Totally.
Yeah.
It's still like that's the frustrating. Like it would be really neat if there was the bit that was the broken bit and the bit that was the good bit and you could just separate them into two.
Yeah,
but it's like that.
Yeah.
So there's very often the stuff that people don't love in the Bible, it's like, yeah, okay, that's later. And the stuff that you kind of, you know, oh, this Melchizedek character that Abraham talks to. Yep, that's simple stuff. God telling Adam and Eve off for learning about good and evil. Okay, that's second simple stuff. It's, you know.
Yeah.
So there you go, Gnosticism explained. Congratulations.
Very cool. Lady, do you have any the follow-up questions, or is any of this any of this material pinged anything within you?
I had a couple of questions about it. I remember being introduced to this a long time back when Bishop Tim was talking about Margaret Barker. And one of the interesting things back then is it seemed as though, I think it was Rowan Williams and Mormons who liked her.
Mm.
And you know, the Mormons were all over this, and at the time when I was trying to look into her, you know, I'm going to look at, okay, what kind of company does this person, do these people keep? And I first saw that Mormons were all over her stuff, even though she's not a Mormon. I thought that was a little interesting. And then I think I'm pretty sure it was Rowan Williams.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
who was the Archbishop of Canterbury at the time?
Absolutely,
yeah.
and a well-known scholar in the radical orthodoxy movement and that sort of thing, which I thought was really kind of an interesting combo. Now, I've seen a lot more about her lately, but it kind of shows how fortunes can change in religious academia. But I didn't know if you had any insight into why Mormons liked her so well.
Oh, sure. Mormons are all about the temple.
Yeah.
The whole, like the whole, you know, for most of us, Mormons are those, you know, nicely dressed young men with the white shirts and black ties and the carefully presented black tile showing up at the front door and asking us if we want to talk about Jesus. But what the depth of Mormonism is what happens inside those large buildings with the golden angel on the roof, right? So where there's a reconstruction of the Jerusalem temple, and Mormons understand themselves to be carrying on the genuine ancient Hebrew temple cult. That is what the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is entirely about. Mm-hmm. So, and a lot of Barker's research has Mormon scholars going, huh, because wow, that's, huh.
Yeah.
You know, because you can't be, I mean, that's the myth, that's the sort of foundation myth of the Church of Latter-day Saints. But you know, if you're an intelligent thinking person in the 21st century, you know, a lot of Mormon scholars are kind of like, yeah, well, that's a good myth, and sure, I mean, you know, we love our faith. And then you read Barker's stuff, and a lot of them are going, oh, although, like, it does actually sound like what we do does sound really similar to what she's talking about. So this is actually seeming, they're finding a new regrounding of the legitimacy of what they're doing in a lot of what Barker's saying. And as you say, she's a Methodist. She's absolutely not a Mormon. But yeah, Mormons love the temple. You know, you Google the word temple and a lot of Mormon scholarship is what shows up, because that's more than any other branch of the Christian and para-Christian faiths, if I can use that term. The temple is the core thing for them. Absolutely.
Absolutely. The other thing was interesting. I was reading a blog by a former Mormon who is now kind of branched into mysticism, and he was talking about Margaret Barker, and I forgive me, I don't remember all the details, but was arguing that Christ's resurrection was actually what happened when he rose up, stood up after his baptism.
Right.
And she associates that and goes to Paul for that. You know, we were buried with him in baptism. And curiously enough, Oneness Pentecostals, non-Trinitarian Pentecostals, for the most part, have a more similar theology of baptism than they may want to admit, because for them, baptism is part and parcel with so-called salvation. The idea is you're burying your old body or the old man or the old woman in baptism, and you're rising up. And by the way, you are baptized in the name of Jesus, not the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, or the Father, the Son, and the feminine principle, whatever she may be. But there is, you know, there's this ecstatic modern religion, Oneness Pentecostalism, that nonetheless, something about their theology of baptism, which is not generally well fleshed out, sounded remarkably similar to what might be suggested here, in that the resurrection was not about what happened after he was crucified, but happened before that during the baptism.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a big thing. I mean, this kind of getting your head straight on what resurrection means, and also getting your head straight on what baptism is about, I think is that's a thread through Barker over a decade or so. Yeah, for sure. So I think obviously controversial, because for lots of Christians, the literal resurrection from death is both your personal hope for the future, and also the belief in that miraculous event validates the legitimacy of the faith. So without those two things, what are we doing? What's Christianity for? I don't think that's characteristic of most of us. I think we see things in a different way. And definitely when you look at something like Gospel of Philip and the kind of sacramental theology that you see in the Gospel of Philip, it's just right there on the page. It's not even hard to understand. It's exactly what it says. You know, your task is to not be a Christian but a Christ, to be anointed, to be one of the anointed ones, to die as part of baptism and to rise to life. There's a line in Philip, I don't have the exact quote, but it's something like, you know, there are people that say that Jesus rose after he died, and that's just wrong-headed. First, he had to rise to life. He had to rise to life before he could die.
Yeah.
Ta-da, you know. Yeah. it's kind of right there. And you know, there's a funny, this is a digression, but in a way, it's a funny thing that the religious structure of this whole system, considered kind of holistically, is something that feels natural and true. The kind of architecting of something which serves the needs of, which serves a different religious vision about control, right? And the suppression of that more original, more kind of naturalistic thing with this version that requires control, and the perpetuation of that, and then the reemergence of this more naturalistic form later after the power that exercises that control wanes, right?
Right.
So that pattern, natural control, reemergence, you just see that pattern happening in all of the Abrahamic faiths. You see it in Judaism, you see it in Christianity, you see it in Islam. You see that pattern of something's trucking along, taking its natural form. Some power comes along and suppresses it in the name of control. It goes underground and then it reemerges in a naturalistic form at some point later. You see that pattern rearticulating itself over and over and over again. You don't see it so much. You don't see it really in Hinduism. You don't really see it in Buddhism. You don't see it in a lot of other faiths, but you see it in Abrahamic religions all the damn time. You see these upwellings of mystical insight suddenly, and then the papacy comes along and steamrollers it, or the caliphate comes along and steamrollers it. You know, it's too many Sufis. Make them stop.
You know, when you were talking earlier about the idea, okay, you've got these temples, you've got these priests, you've got these cults, and all of a sudden you have a king or somebody comes in, consolidates everything, and then oopsie daisy, the Babylonians take over. When you've got something that's consolidated, it's a heck of a lot easier for that to be captured, captured, and then taken over by empire. You know, and Philip K. Dick talks about the empire never ended. That never really changes. But when you have a less consolidated religion, there may be less power involved, but it's also less likely to be kidnapped,
right,
by a ruling or a conquering power,
right.
And that was just going through my head when you were talking about this.
Well, so arguably, the impulse towards orthodoxy always ends up in empire. Because the only way you can maintain that level of consistency is by having centralized control, and the only way for that centralized control to not be captured by a rival power is to become the power itself.
Right.
To gradually evolve to become the most powerful political force available, and that's the only way it can keep itself safe.
Well, I think of empires also, I mean, they're certainly controlling by use of superior force, but there's also, with that control, that level of control, there's a disconnection as well, because you've got a empire that may be consolidated in one country where the rulers don't even speak the language of some people that they are supposedly ruling, and yet they're using this overarching force when there's actually no real relationship there. So
absolutely.
there's a lot to be worked with here, and I think given the current unpleasantness around the world that we're seeing right now, we're seeing dismantling of institutions and things kind of falling apart. This is really striking me as perhaps a way of thinking about what has happened, where you've got people who are under the authority of somebody who there's power over, but there is no genuine relationship whatsoever.
Right. Definitely.
100%.
Chair recognizes Father Tony.
Hey, wait. Now I'm unmuted for the stream. Sorry. I am joining you from the depths of the internet to share an interesting question we just had in chat. Lucas asks, is there any relationship between temple theology and Grail mysticism? Have you given any thought to that? Are you aware of any connections or interesting ideas?
Obviously not off the cuff, because that's not the face I make if I've got something off the cuff.
I mean, I'll just go with a yes, and Lucas, we'll get back to you on that. But I think the Grail is greatly associated with one, mysticism, right? So whenever you have Abrahamic mysticism, you're going to have a tie to temple theology, right? I think it's probably simple as that if you accept the Barker's thesis. And then two, the Grail is associated with feminine figures at all times, right? It's also associated with healing, and it's associated with
healing and wholeness, which is such a characteristic of the First Temple Covenant, and also the servant king.
The
wounded king and the fisher king figure, but the servant king, the king who understands that his job is to fully give himself for the people and the land. And that's exemplified in the atonement ritual as Barker reconstructs it, because the king as the high priest anoints I love saying this because it's just really fun. So the king is the Lord, right? And then taking on there's the two goats, the scapegoat that takes on the sins of the people and is driven into the wilderness and not killed, note, and then the goat, which is anointed as the Lord. So follow along at home. The high priest is the Lord. The Lord is the Lord. And the goat is the Lord. They're all the Lord, right?
Yeah.
We slaughter the goat, which is the Lord giving of himself and of his own body and blood in order to reunite the bonds of covenant between the land and the people. So it's symbolic, because if the king kills himself, the king's dead. So you've got to find a way to do it that isn't literal. And then the blood of the goat is sprinkled around the Holy of Holies, which is symbolic of day one and the beginning of creation. So the literal blood of the land is sprinkled into the... So it creates these kind of covenantal loops between the phenomenal and the spiritual realm, by weaving all these things together, and then the priests eat the organs of the goat, and the whole thing's woven together. Let's not do the Thomas digression right now, although I feel a strong pressure to do it, but let's leave that to later. But yes, so if you like, Lucas, perhaps you might consider the Grail being a lot of this, and that's a very, all those images I've just said are very sort of Middle Eastern images. In a way, it's kind of grounded in the kind of the desert context of the Hebrew religion. Perhaps if you take earlier religious and spiritual motifs in Central and Northern Europe, and then reflect those same patterns of servant leadership, of wholeness, of reweaving the land and the divine realm with sacrifice and with self-sacrifice of the leader and blood. The way those things echo with more Northern European imagery looks like Grail myth, perhaps. Grail myth's one way to make sense of it.
I'd say 100%. Like, once you start talking about the servant king, it really, anybody who knows the Fisher King story, right, their head is going to perk up. And then if you think of the Grail as a feminine image, it's also associated with wisdom, right? To drink from the Grail is to experience Gnosis, which, right. Which the Lady of the Temple is the one who's associated both with chalices, well, the bread with Barker, but is associated, with wisdom and breaking wisdom. So I think, I think we're on to something here, and I think Lucas is on to something here. I'll talk a little bit, going back, to rewind, with Bishop Lady talking about the Barker, the baptism. Jesus' baptism is his resurrection. I think she actually does believe in two resurrections, but the one from the baptism is the most important one, and that's the one, actually, I think in Barker's thought, and I might have this wrong, there's only one resurrection. After his baptism, Jesus becomes a divine being, right? Because he's actually had an ascent experience where he's united with the Lord, and then he becomes fully the Lord on earth. And then that is echoed. We have to get out of our Greek, logical, everything has strong boundaries. You know, that becomes echoed with the resurrection after his crucifixion. But that's the most important one that causes the second resurrection to actually happen. And then going back to that once again, when we're talking about the echoes of Gnosticism, a lot of Gnostics believed they were adoptionists. So they didn't believe that Jesus was born a divine being. But at his baptism, he became a divine being. So that sounds very Barker. And one last thing, jumping on some of the things that Bishop Laney said, you know, talk about Mormons and Pentecostals and finding these reflections in temple theology. And that's because we don't need an unbroken secret tradition passed from mouth to ear. Just by having the texts and doing these rituals, because it is, there's a seed of it at all times, buried within the frameworks, it's going to organically blossom. Also kind of talk about what Bishop Tim was saying with the cycle of oppression and freedom, which carries through the Abrahamic traditions, right? I think these two things are connected, because temple theology and mysticism is always there in the texts and the rituals. So it's going to organically be teased out, even when people don't mean to.
I wanted to bring out a thing about the, just in relation to what you were just saying there, and Bishop Lanny, what you were saying a little earlier about the nature of control and of centralization and of empire. There's a I think we focus on oppression and power and domination when we think about that kind of that control paradigm. But also that safety. How do we establish safety? We get codes of practice and good regulations, and we ensure that people follow the regulations. And you know, the standard way you establish safety procedures in any workplace is by power and control, right? Control backed up by power. We see this very vividly in our current time, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And that distinction between domination and safety is very much the fabric of the discourse around the current pandemic, right? But that's important. The safety thing's important, because why would anybody stand for that kind of controlling force coming down on this more powerful, naturalistic, mystical religious tradition? Because bluntly, the naturalistic, mystical stuff is crazy, drives people nuts. They go off the rails. Not everyone can handle it. It's difficult. You've got to work hard. It's messy. You fall to pieces. People have nervous breakdowns. There's spiritual emergencies happening all over the place. You listen to Irenaeus talking, you know, in the Against Heresies, you know, but part of what he's complaining about is just these random prophets blow into town and they say all kinds of stuff. He doesn't say this, I'm paraphrasing. I'm trying to stop people getting literally thrown to lions here. And you've got these crazy people showing up, the teaching's going all nuts. And he's trying to just sort of keep everything in a kind of a neat box so he can establish some kind of, you know, if you're being uncharitable, power. If you're being more charitable, safety for his community, who he's literally trying to keep physically safe, right? But there's two kinds of power. There's that sort of naturalistic, mystical power that emerges out of the tradition. And there's this pressure for safety and control and popularity and ease of access. Being that, you know, it's much easier to show up on Sunday, sing a couple of hymns, praise some Jeebus, you know, do an altar call, get saved, sorry, or get confirmed and become a Catholic or what, you know, whatever. The exoteric versions of all of our faiths are designed to be easy to access, safe to participate in, until they're not, you know, and under control. Whereas the mystical stuff by nature can't be controlled. So that's the sort of, it's not even a dialectic, it's a cycle model of like two powerful forces contending with each other that kind of drive that loop. This is a long way off temple theology, but Margaret Barker says nothing about cycle models.
I have really it's a ramble and a statement, less
that
than
is
a question.
That is out of character for this whole episode, Jonathan.
Yes,
I don't know.
Yeah. out of question for me in general. But here we go. Coming back to the theosis. So we already discussed how there's this type model of theosis that, and for people following along at home, theosis is becoming divine, right? That it's tightly regulated in the original First Temple cult. Then it becomes open source. So there's the two largest groups of Gnostics. There's one called the Cephians and one called the Valentinians. The Valentinians had a ritual that seems to be connected to theosis, how they became gods on earth. We don't know what this ritual consisted of. We have some hints. One, it's called a bridal chamber, but it's also referred to in the Gospel of Philip and some other Valentinian texts as the Holy of the Holies. People seem to think that it involves some sort of mirror, perhaps a mirror and candle, some sort of retreat where reflection is used. The other thing too is that it's a union with your divine double, with an angel who is a divine version of you who hasn't fallen and is still in the wholeness, still with the first father, still in the Pleroma. So that to me sounds like temple talk and an open sourcing of the ritual. So in Barker's thought, the king priest goes into the Holy of the Holies, and according to her, the Holy of the Holies was a cubic room which was layered in reflective gold, and he went in with a torch, and it would have been really something to see at that time, right? So here we have entering into a kind of retreat, a mirrored surface. It's called the Holy of the Holies. And then the other thing too is, according to Barker, the priests with an S, the plural, and not the priest king, but the other priests who served in the temple, were thought of as angels, again, in this mysterious way that is breaks down boundaries, which no clear definitions, but somehow the priests are both priests on earth, and they're also angels in heaven. So here we have someone becoming, unifying with an angel, with their angelic double, becoming divine in the Holy of Holies from a reflective surface. Now, part one.
That's part one. Okay.
Part two.
I already have thoughts.
Okay. go for it. Jump in. What do you think about that?
Do part two. I can come back. It's all right.
Okay. So part two. We have the Cephians. Their divination ritual to become divine was called the Five Seals. Again, we don't know exactly what it was, but John Turner says that he thinks he's figured it out, that it's investiture. So investiture, you're given the robes, baptism, enthronement, glorification, and rapture.
Nice.
Yeah,
that is good.
And those five things sound exactly like the king-making ritual that you were discussing before, right? When the king is, he's given a form of baptism, he's given him a chrism, he's sat upon a chair, his kingly robes are placed upon him. That's the enthronement. The glorification is when he stands, then celestial rapture. So this is a different version, slightly different version of the open sourcing of how to become divine. So the Valentinians take some aspects of it, the Cephians take some other aspects of it.
But the essential bits are all there. Yeah, bang on. Yeah. I think that's perfect. I think, you know, I've been saying open source and jailbroken for a couple of years, but that, in this conversation, I'm kind of thinking, you know what, with the only textual evidence, the only evidence that we have is for the royal high priest, the enthronement of the royal high priest and that whole anointing and resurrection stuff. The only evidence we have for any of that is textual. There's nothing obviously archaeological and whatever. So all we've got is the text. And the texts only talk about the enthronement of the king. Yeah. The fact that the priests, the rest of the priesthood in the temple are considered angels sort of implies, I mean, with everything you've just said, sort of implies they've also undergone a bridal chamber ritual where they've been united with a heavenly double because they are angels.
Yeah.
So they're not angels because someone snapped their fingers. They're presumably angels because they went through some ritual action that united them with their angel double, and that's why they get to act as angels. I mean, that's, you know, which has no parallels to the ordination process at all, obviously. there's nothing familiar there. But that's not recorded that happened. Only the royal high priest. You know, but the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, right? So just because we only hear about the king undergoing resurrection doesn't mean only the king underwent resurrection. Yeah. There's decent evidence that the priesthood also underwent resurrection of their own. And who's to say, you know, lots of temples, lots of doors. Who's to say there weren't lodge groups and mystical groups undergoing their own thing at the time of the first temple that were also doing this union between, I mean, because so much of the theology is about the union between the divine and the human.
Yeah.
Exactly. Then why wouldn't any person that wanted to become more involved in their spiritual life undergo a similar ritual? So perhaps this jailbreaking that we're positing taking several centuries to happen and fully coming to flower in the first century CE, perhaps that had been going on the entire time and just not written down and not part of the kind of overt structure of the way things worked.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. Obviously, it's speculative, but you could see people, particularly if they have a mystical bent, being like, I want to be an angel. I would like to be deified, please.
Let's do that. I think there's just a little nuance there that I think it's worth picking out. You know, you're united with your heavenly double, the angel who is your heavenly double. Okay, so if you're the king of the country, mm-hmm. then your angel double is the Lord, because that's the angel of the people.
Yes, that'd be the king of the angels.
That's the king of the king of the angels, but also the angel of the people of Israel, right? Yod HaVaveh is the Lord of Israel, specifically, yep. And the king is the Lord of Israel in the phenomenal world, and so that's the heavenly double just for the king, not for everybody, just for the king, right?
Exactly. This actually streams quite well into our next question, and thank you, Lucas, who already touched on this. But do you see any similarities between temple theology and sort of later Western esotericism? So stuff like Kabbalah, the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, Freemasonry, Martinism, you know, what have you?
Yes.
Okay, next question. No, what are some of these similarities that you see in some of these groups and bodies of thought?
Well, I mean, one of the things that... so Kabbalah is temple talk, right? So one way to see it is it's a... You know, and the reason Kabbalah is often quite controversial in Jewish circles, right? Like, it's not... It's esoteric. It's like not everybody ought to do it. It's, you know, you've got a, there's all sorts of safety controls over who's allowed to participate exactly for good reasons. But, you know, Judaism represents aspects of Hebrew religion that are preserved in diaspora as Jerusalem's destroyed, you know, the nation of Israel sacked and the people are driven out into diaspora. So, at some point, you've got to work out of all the stuff that we were able to do when we were home, what's important to keep. And so Judaism, as it exists in its various threads and modes today, represents what everybody thought was worth keeping. You know, what could be done when you're moving around a lot and when you're getting displaced from place to place, and then what's crucial. So Kabbalah represents a part of what's crucial, as does Merkabah mysticism, is an aspect that is crucial. And both Merkabah and Kabbalah are temple stuff, right? They're not, like, you've got to work really hard to make sense of Kabbalah with, you know, there's a lot of work, there's a lot of stuff written to try to make Kabbalah make sense in the context of Torah, right?
Yeah.
They work really hard at it for a long time, so much so that you can almost believe it. But it takes a lot of work. Whereas understanding Kabbalah as a kind of, you know, textual maps of mystical experiences that are undergone, you know, in the rapture phase of Turner's five seals, if you like, after glorification, that they're visionary, you know, there's sort of naturalistic visionary experiences that happen in the context of the temple. That Kabbalah is a map of the structure of that goes on with that. And then it's been sort of, you know, kind of, okay, that can, you know, we can justify that in terms of Torah to kind of make it sense. Any actual Jewish Kabbalist is probably, like, you know, livid with fury at the moment. I apologize if you feel that's doing violence to your tradition. I don't intend it that way. I'm kind of intending it to just say, in parallel with the really strong textual emphasis in modern Judaism, there's also these more fluid, direct, mystical aspects to the tradition that kind of flourish alongside it. And I think it's easier to see that grounded in the earlier mystical cult than it is to see it in the later, more kind of legalistic cult that you see characteristic of the kind of century before the first century BCE. So there's that. I can't speak to Freemasonry because I'm not a Mason. I don't understand enough about the tradition to kind of really, really speak to that. But what was the you said Masonry, Kabbalah,
I'll jump in for Freemasonry for a second, just for a quick comparison. I too am not a Freemason, but I've read some.
I mean, they're obsessed with the temple. You people are obsessed with the temple.
They won't stop talking about the temple, and it's the first temple too. So it's the main metaphor for Freemasonry. The Masons are the ones who build the first temple, and if you engage with some of the material, even if you're not initiated, there's still pop culture books that you can read, right? That's all they talk about is the temple. It reminded me so much of Barker. And touching on a few things about Kabbalah too, right? There's a famous diagram which is both God and us and the universe called the Tree of Life. And according to Barker, the tree is one of the symbols of the lady. And there's even a Trinity. Like what you're talking about at the beginning, at the top of the tree, there's the supernal triad, which is Hakma, Bina, and Kether, which is often Kodesh, masculine and female, or sometimes ongendered masculine and female, which also sounds like this, the Lord, the unknown father, and wisdom, like you were discussing before.
Yeah.
What was I going to say? Oh yeah, so there's Kabbalah, Kabbalistic Tree of Life, Masonry, Martinism, any other groups at all, or any other sort of streams.
It's all that stuff. All the Western esoteric stuff is all drawing on the depth of this. If it's drawing on, I mean, we talked about this on the last podcast, is the sort of posited link between Plato. So Plato draws from Pythagoras, and Pythagoras draws from the temple.
Yeah.
It's not that. I mean, you know, kind of saying, well, it's Greek infused because it sounds like Plato is kind of, well, but Plato sounds Hebrew because the origin of Pythagoreanism. Pythagoras was educated in Syria, which means Israel, really, at the time. That's the word Greeks used for that time. Just random stuff. Yeah. So anything in Western esotericism is the deep underground stream. It's not a single coherent thing. It's a body of thought and practiced over a large space, over a long period of time, that took lots of different forms. And we tend to kind of simplify these things down into, look, there's a father and a son, and there's this divine feminine. But there's probably multiple divine feminines, right? And the sense of sonship takes multiple forms. It takes that royal form, which is very well documented, but it probably takes other forms. The sense of one of the beautiful things in Secret Book of John is quite the sort of interpenetrative way that gender is used in a much more playful way than we're familiar with. I mean, the Greek stuff is very fixated on, well, this is masculine because it is penetrating, and this is feminine because it is receptive. This is passive and therefore feminine, whereas the masculine is active. You read Secret John, that's just not there. You know, everybody's moving around and dancing, and this is a mother father, and maybe that's a kind of father which has maternal things, and there's breasts, and also that's what even without even going to the paraphrase of Shem. You know, like there's gender's fun in Gnosticism. It's all over the place, and it plays all these generative, interesting roles. It's not a categorization system. And so it's quite possible that that's characteristic of this older form of Hebrew mysticism that we kind of see in that less controlled, less centralized kind of mode. It's worth also name checking that, you know, we're talking about the research on this isn't super clear, but there's so many parallels between what we're calling ancient Hebrew religion and what you'd call Canaanite religion, because it's the same body of land, it's largely the same people, it's a lot of the same temple complexes that just evolve over 500, 600, 700, 800 years, a millennium, stuff like that. So, you know, there's not a clear, there's not like a hard dividing line. The hard dividing line we put between Canaanite religion and Hebrew religion is monotheism. Canaanites were polytheistic. As we all know, Hebrews were monotheistic. Yeah. Well, kinda. We also put this hard dividing line between Egypt and Israel, between Egyptian religion and Hebrew religion. But that's hard to do as well. The Egyptians had colonies in Israel, right? Like the Bible records the people of Israel being slaves in Egypt, or some subsection of some version of some part of the people of Israel being slaves in, right? You've got to really, that's a constructed history. It's not, there's very little exterior non-biblical evidence for the facts that are stated in Exodus. And everybody universally pretty much accepts that, except for fundamentalists. But also Egyptians lived in Israel. There was Egyptian colonies in Israel. There's a mining colony in the north of Israel that mined lapis lazuli to ship to Egypt. And there were Egyptian temples. There's an Egyptian temple to Hathor at Serabat al-Kadem that's been uncovered in archaeology. So also at the various sort of territorial high points of the Egyptian empire, everything that we're calling everything up to Syria was Egypt.
Yeah.
Egypt extended all the way up through what's currently Israel, Palestine, and Syria up to Jordan, pretty much. That was Egypt, right? Which raises the prospect, did the people of Israel leave Egypt, or did Egypt leave the people of Israel?
Yeah, exactly. And it's not like obviously there were some boundaries and there were some walls, but in the ancient world, you know.
In the ancient world and over such enormous spans of time, we're talking about the ancient world over a period of 1,000 years. So there's at a certain point in time, there are clear boundaries that are obviously policed by border guards. But that goes that way, and then it goes that way, and then that empire collapses, and there's a drought, and the whole thing falls over, and then there's another empire, and then the Hittites appear, and then the Sea Peoples, and you know, then there's climate change, and the whole thing collapses. And I mean, it was a very vivid time. But seriously, like there's a big collapse period where a lot of the major empires around the eastern side of the Mediterranean all just fell to pieces. There's no writing for several hundred years, and going theory is that was a climate change moment. There was a massive catastrophe, big crop failures, large droughts, lots of people died, all the empires collapsed, and it took a couple of hundred years for everything to get rebuilt.
Yeah, exactly. So you and I are both the Johannites. We're in the Apostolic Johannite Church. Do you see any similarities between temple theology and some of the Johannite legends?
They're obsessed with the temple.
Yeah.
Are there specific Johannite legends you'd like to kind of pick out?
Yeah, like John the Baptist and the Apostle John being connected to the temple. Both, you know, the Baptist's father is a priest, right? And mm-hmm. then there's also the idea of a secret tradition in the Johannite legends, right? John the Baptist
right.
knows something that he tells to both Jesus and to his disciple John, right? Because John is originally the disciple of John.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that sounds like pretty temple-y to me.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think definitely. It's also notable that, you know, an institutional narrative, you know, the continuation of the Johannite tradition, the way it kind of emerges into Europe, is the encounter between the Knights of the Temple and Theoclete in Jerusalem. And the Knights of the Temple are in Jerusalem, and they're called the Knights of the Temple
yeah.
because they're going to Jerusalem to get access to the freaking temple. And in the course of that endeavor, that adventure, they run into a guy who goes, "Ah, you're the people I've been looking for," and makes the Grand Master of the Temple as the sovereign pontiff of the Church of John. Right? Why yep. would he do that? Why is he there? Right? For starters, like, why Jerusalem? I mean, obviously Jerusalem's the Holy Land, but there's safer places for a secret church to be, I think you could say. It's that
yep.
because it's so contended, it's a pretty messy place. And why these guys call themselves the Knights of the Temple. So there's obviously just a direct temple link there. And then the Johannite lineage, according to tradition, gets carried through the Grand Masters of the Knights of the Temple. Sorry, I should wash some of that kind of skepticism out of my voice when I say it. It's my own tradition. According to tradition, the Johannite lineage gets carried through the Templar order over the next several hundred years.
And each John, each leader is called John, which means beloved of God, and is anointed, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so then also Johannite tradition, at least in the kind of the post-medieval era, explicitly kind of, you know, there's the Church of John, Church of Peter mm-hmm. kind of dichotomy. And the Church of John sees itself as the mystical heart of the church, whereas the Church of Peter is that orthodox, centralized, rule-oriented, kind of administrative kind of version of Christianity. So that's our two kind of things again, you know, that we were talking about before. So the Church of John poses itself as that underground tradition that connects it to that older stuff. I think that's that kind of organic, naturalistic stuff. And I mean, I think at least in that's very satisfying for me, because I feel like, you know, Johannite tradition takes lots of different forms and lots of different places. The AJC is one tiny, tiny, tiny holographic shard of the whole thing. You know, there's lots of people being Johannite churches all over the place, and the Johannite tradition weaves its way through most independent churches and most Gnostic churches. But that kind of centralized control versus sort of the naturalistic, heartfelt upwelling of awe and wonder at the interconnection between the spiritual and the phenomenal world is very satisfying to me, because that's kind of the vibe that I think we try to make contact with in terms of what we're doing. So that depiction of things fits how I feel, you know, the essence of the AJC to be. So I kind of not that we always express it in the most effective way, not that we're still stuck, you know, we're so young and we're so new to this and we're stumbling around trying to. It's funny, I think, when we've been around for 5 years, we thought we were, like, you know, really grown up. And now that we've been around for 20 years, it's like, oh, my gosh, it's, like, so early. We've only just started. There's still so much to do, you know. I feel like we're... ...in connection. That's a felt thing, but not a scholarly thing.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're starting to brush up against time for you have to go. It's evening where Lady and I are, but it's the morning of the workday for you. Before we get to some final questions, I'm going to call out to my angelic double, Father Tony, if there's any interesting questions in the chat. But Father Tony, are you there? I should start with a crystal ball. Here we go.
Just reach for the skull behind you. That'd be the
yeah. Father yeah. Tony, are you there?
I am here. Yes. Okay. Yeah, there was one question that about the role of Sophia in this whole business. Is there a connection to the Gnostic figure of Sophia that you could point to?
Heck yes, heck yes. So this is going to be a slightly long answer, but I think it's worth making. What you see in First Temple religion is this intensely powerful, incredibly active, transcendently and imminently salvific figure of the Great Lady. And that there's archaeological evidence and textual evidence that she was such a massive, intense and central figure in the earlier cult. The archaeological evidence amongst it, there's these... if you Google Judean pillar figurine, this is one of my favorite things. There's these little terracotta images that are archaeologically found all across the territory that indicates that people just had them in their homes. They're these little rudimentary handmade little figurines. So there's a feminine figure of divinity universally venerated in households all over Judea and Israel. So go ahead.
Oh, wait, I want to interrupt just for a sec because it's basically, I know you're building up something great, I'm interrupting of something stupid, but it's like you basically can't take a shovel in Israel-Palestine. If you stick a shovel into ground and take out a shovel's worth of dirt, you're going to find these terracotta statues of the Great Lady. It's ridiculous.
There are thousands of them. It's nuts, yep. which indicates that whatever people thought was supposed to be happening in the temple, ordinary people were still doing their thing for like throughout this whole period. So she was like a big deal. Okay, so then, and she's not lost, because what we have in the scriptures that emerge out of Josiah, the captivity and the return, the version of scriptures, of Hebrew scriptures that we have from that period, still have the Spirit of God moving over the face of the waters. They still have the idea of the Shekinah, the presence of God in the temple. They still have wisdom showing up all the way through the wisdom literature. Wisdom of Solomon, Proverbs. She shows up in Psalms a fair bit. So there's still this divine feminine figure. She's elusive and mysterious and not very present. Comes across as important. She was with God in the beginning, you know, in the wisdom of Solomon. Important, but elusive and mysterious and not direct and powerful in the way that the image of the lady is. So something has happened. She's been kind of attenuated and kind of stepped down and reduced in her role and made less effective. So what we see in Secret John, to kind of come back to that parodic structure of Secret John, where the lower realm is both a polemic against the Second Temple cult, his theory, and a parody of the higher realm, and also therefore a parody of the First Temple cult. So Sophia in Secret John is Second Temple wisdom. Barbalo in Secret John is the lady from the First Temple. Barker notes, a lot of people stress out about what Barbalo might mean and where the word might come from, because it's clearly not Hebrew and it's not really Greek. And Barker just, in a side note somewhere in a chapter, says, well, Barbaloa, right? So God in four. It's fourfold, you know. Anyway, moving on. You kind of go, blah, 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 that's a really big deal. Hold up, Margaret. What are you talking about? So the first, like, Barbalo is pronoia. She is the first thought. She is the first self-recollection of the one. the one as it regards itself, that's self-reflection, that first awareness of itself, that first consciousness is itself the lady, and then she goes on to become this massive figure that figures in all. So she's called Pronoia in some texts and Barbalo specifically in Secret John. She's the lady in the first temple conception.
Right.
And then wisdom, Sophia in Secret John, is wisdom as it's configured in the second temple. And this is really significant, I think, because she's a bit, you know, she kind of stuffs up, she does some dumb things break. I've got to be qualified, this is different from Sophia as she shows up in some later texts, where the later depiction of Sophia is a kind of a merge of Barbalo and the sort of second temple Sophia. Lainey, I can see you're prepping something you want to try to bust in with. Go ahead.
I remember, one of the books of Enoch, they talk about wisdom. But wisdom there is a childlike figure. Mm-hmm. There's almost like, you know, I was God's delight. I danced around. And I was, you know, there was this very, she becomes a childlike figure. Something that God delights in, but not necessarily as a powerful figure, or certainly a first thought or a forethought. So I think that I'm just pointing that out, that there's another depiction there in which she is childlike, and there's a sense of almost a diminishment in there as well. And then of course there is Thunder Perfect Mind. Now there's some debate about what, you know, who was being spoken of. I think there's been more scholarship on that.
Not from me.
but it's a very, very, you know, she is an entirely different thing altogether.
Well, she is everything, right? Yeah. Like that's what Thunder Perfect Mind does. So I think that's crucially important. So this figure of the lady that we've got from that deeper, older part of the tradition, she's not a mother. She's a mother. That she whose wedding is great, but she has not taken a husband. What? I am the mother and the members of my mother, and I am also my daughter and the members of my son, and I am, you know, I am she who is abject and she who is wise, and, you know. So all those contradictions in Thunder Perfect Mind are designed to mess with your head in such a way that any fixed idea of that she's some archetype or she's some specific anything get busted.
Yeah.
You read Thunder Perfect Mind out loud and you've got no fixed anything left in your head. And that's the lady. That's the lady. So she is a child and she is the queen mother and she is the maiden in the market and she is the Mata Hari secret super spy and she is the Lara Croft and she is the throne and she is the tree of wisdom and she is the shoebread and she is the cup and she is the etc.
And was she the daughter of Fortitude, who scared the bejesus out of Kelly and Dee?
She sure was. Again, I'll link that text. Hopefully I'll remember to do all these links because I love that text. I hope that we get to do a talk about it more in depth on Talk
Notes. That'd be fun.
But it really reads like a sequel to Thunder Perfect Mind, which was lost at that time. It's really
mind-blowing. I mean, that's one of those things where, you know, it's one of those moments when you've been doing this for a while, you know, you want to keep your feet grounded, but then you encounter something like that and you say, maybe there really is something to all this.
Hildegard of Bingen, and Sapientia and those giant feminine figures that she writes about in her writing as well. It's really connected to that. Sorry, Lainey, I lost the plot for a second because I decided you were talking about a TV show with some people called Kelly and Dee, and I figured this was a cultural reference that you guys had in common and I was missing. And then I gradually realized you meant Edward Kelly and John Dee.
Yes.
I'm back. Sorry. I want to stick with the Sophia question a little bit because I like to just do that because people love to talk a lot about Sophia. And I think actually the depiction of Barbalo and also Thunder, you need to blow your head open because Sophia is much vaster than this neat, cute little figure that we often get presented with. So there's this other thing. There's this tactic that we see in the Christian era where powerful feminine figures are multiplied in order to diminish them. So there's scholarship that a lot of the presence of Mary Magdalene in scripture, Mary becomes Martha at some points, and then there's Mary of Bethany, and then there's Mary Magdalene, and then maybe So there's multiple feminine figures kind of invented to reduce and reduce the significance of the role of the Magdalene. So she becomes more marginal and less central to the narrative. So it's a way of diminishing her. I think there's a similar ploy because the lady, I think there's a reasonable and very, very well-grounded argument that the figure of the lady appears most vividly as the Paraclete, as the Pneuma Agion, as the Holy Spirit in New Testament scripture, but that doesn't encompass her role as the Mother of the Lord. And so she also emerges more vividly in prayer text than more vividly in iconography and art as the Theotokos, as Mary, the Mother of Jesus. So there's a lot of that imagery around Mary is echoes lady imagery. Well, so then we see this same tactic, right? So the salvific power of the lady is the Holy Spirit, who's ungendered and becomes actually neutered, literally neutered in Greek. Pneuma Agion is a neuter gendered grammatically of the neutral gender and becomes the Spiritus Sanctus in Latin, who is masculine. So she's defeminized and then masculinized and then disappears as a feminine figure. And simultaneously, gentle Mary, meek and mild, appears to absorb all the maternal characteristics, and her backgrounding role is emphasized. So she's the throne of the Lord. You know, Jesus is sitting on her knee. She's the Queen of Heaven. Very sweet, very sweet Queen of Heaven. Not the grand commandress of the armies of heaven, but this kind of very sweet figure, kind of perched on the moon. You know, so she's sort of reduced into the background. But if you take everything that's said about Mary and every role that's assigned to the Holy Spirit and pull them together in your head, then read Thunder Perfect Mind.
Well,
kind of got
the flavor. And then this brings up to mind also the Trinity of Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. Mm-hmm. And Miriam is the sister who oversees the safety of her brother. She negotiates getting him safely into Egypt. But then she is a prophetess who was clearly very honored by her people, because after she died, the Israelites refused to move, or in the story, they refused to move for 2 months. But she is, her power is gradually weakened. We have Moses as the lawgiver, the governor. We have Aaron as the priest, but she is the prophetess. She's the one who speaks the spirit. But interestingly, after Aaron and Miriam criticize Moses' choice of wife, they're both punished, but she is punished very badly, and then she just kind of disappears. And a lot of Bible scholars will take some glee in pointing out that she was a bad woman and she had to be removed, despite the fact that the story also makes it clear that the people would not move for 2 months after her death because they were mourning her. So we have another Mary.
Very, 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 very clearly. That's a very conscious Second Temple move to absorb the royal trinity from First Temple practice, recuperate it, give it a different form, and explain why the lady's been lost.
But if you look, so there you have this other trinity that you can see where that's been removed. Curiously, there are debates about women's ordination, both within and without Roman Catholicism, that will separate various roles of authority and will acknowledge, men can be, are governors and they are the priests, they do those priestly acts, but it's okay for a woman to take a prophetic role, at least for a while, until things get established. So this is actually mirrored in women's status within ecclesiastical communities very, very clearly.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and certainly the role of the prophet diminished radically in Christianity once things got established, right?
And Max Weber looked at that when he was doing his work on sociology of religion. This is a very standard move.
Yeah, right.
100%. I'll say one more, sort of going back a little bit back to the Sophia, the Lady of the Temple. So the temple represents the universe, right? As above, so below. And it's everything in the temple symbolically represents something in the cosmology. And this is actually not just a Hebrew thing, or not just a Christian thing, not just a Jewish thing. If you've studied religion or done some interfaith work, this is a pretty common sort of
pretty common
experience. Yes. Mm-hmm. The temples and holy places represent the universe. So what King Josiah does is he removes the lady from the temple, actually in a physical, literal way, right? He takes out the symbols of the lady and takes them out of the temple and throws them in the garbage. And in some versions of the Sophia myth, so the temple is the universe, specifically, you know, the holy of the holies, the back part of the temple, the special part of the temples are the highest heavens, right? So the lady is kicked out in a literal sense of the highest heavens. And in some versions of the Gnostic myth, Sophia falls from the Pleroma, the highest heavens.
Right. And in Secret John, she's even banned from the lowest as well.
Yes,
She's left trapped in this intermediate zone between the realm of the Demiurge and the realm of the First Father. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I kind of, the role, the fate of Sophia in Secret John, I got very transfixed by my local group. We've been doing, spent 6 months sort of digging, you know, really cheering on Secret John and trying to get our heads around it together. And I've been doing the lady research around the same sort of time. And so that, you know, when we get to that point of what happens to Sophia, it just really struck me, you know, the polemic against Yaldabaoth and against the Archons, these kind of lower versions of the First Father and the Aeons that you see in the realm. You know, they're vile and they're filthy and they're tainted with corruption. All they can do is create a counterfeit spirit who speaks of lies, and it's pretty hard language, right? But the worst they can do with the lady, with the Second Temple version of the lady, is say, well, she made a bit of a mistake and she's kind of in this sad place now where we've got to rescue her, right? Mm. That's the worst they can do.
Yeah.
That's the harshest thing they can do to the lady, which speaks, I think, to how core the veneration of her was through. You couldn't do worse than that. They couldn't get rid of her out of the Second Temple cult. And also people trying to criticize the Second Temple cult could be absolutely harsh and polemic about all aspects of it except her. You had to be as gentle as possible. And it really reminds me of that line Jesus gets in the Gospel of Matthew that, you know, anything can be forgiven except blasphemy against the Holy Spirit.
Yeah. 100%. Well,
because she's the savior. If you blaspheme that, you've wrecked the system. It's broken. So,
yeah. I mean, that is a line that people have been arguing over and not understood for 2,000 years, right? So,
and we've cracked it in this podcast. So
there we go.
Fixed. We fixed Christianity. Nice. Yeah. Well done, everyone.
Well, I think that's a good note to start to wrap up. So thanks again, Bishop Tim. And I think this has been fascinating. It's actually a bit of a bonus episode. We ran a little long. And I thank everybody out there for their great questions. So I guess we will say goodbye, and I'll summon again my angelic double to end the show.
Thanks a lot for having me on. It's been a really fun chat. I really appreciate the questions, and I love this stuff. I love talking about it. So thanks for the time to speak a bit more.
Pleasure.
Pleasure.
Bye.